This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, the NSA spying revelations. What kind of threat do they represent to civil liberties in the U.S.? And how will the scandal affect the Obama presidency? And preserving a key site in African American history. But first, people's lawyer Lynn Stewart remains stuck in a federal prison facility in Fort Worth, Texas, while stage 4 breast cancer drains away the days of her life. Stewart was sentenced to 10 years for zealously defending her client in the 1993 Twin Towers bombing case. Tens of thousands have petitioned for her compassionate release from prison, but the process has apparently stalled at the highest levels of the Obama administration. Lynn Stewart's husband and comrade in struggle, Ralph Pointer, has taken up a vigil in Washington.
I am at a vigil in front of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to publicize the reality that the people who worked to make Obama and every voter possible are being ignored by those people. So I want to bring attention to that. I want to bring attention to Lynn's plight. 4 months ago, they gave her 18 to 24 months to live. Cancer is still spreading. The warden at Fort Worth, Texas, concedes that she complies with the 1984 Compassionate Release Act. The papers sit on the desk of Samuels, and we know that he is not the last word. And I would recommend, and I recommend people to talk to Obama, to go to the basement, to get the placard that Harry S. Truman had. He had on his desk and said, "The buck stops here." And I would also ask people for him, for Obama, to look for the placard of Truman that said, "If you can't stand the heat, don't get in the queue." We need Lynn free. It doesn't need much to get her there. And we must remember, if we cannot get Lynn Stewart free, who they attacked for saying a word, what opportunity do we have to get our brothers who fought and defended us free? We must ask or demand a sign from Obama that he is about to change his ways and support the people who support him.
As far as you can determine, who is the bottleneck in processing Lynn into compassionate release?
Bureaucratically, the paper sits on the desk of Samuels, the head of the warden of the federal prison system. But we all know that it's just a link in a bureaucratic chain, and we all know that Obama and Holger can move this with a stroke of a pen. We're not talking about pardon. We're just talking about following a protocol, procedure that they normally follow. When the man on the street, that is the warden of the local prison, gives the okay for compliance for compassionate release, it is rarely stopped at the federal level. Here we have that situation. It stopped at the federal level. Ramsey Clark has been to the offices of Samuels, Obama, and Eric Holder, and nothing has happened. So much for the wheels of justice or injustice turning it all. They look to kill Lynn, and her voice is what they always feared, and they're going to hold her as long as possible, I believe, in the form of Marilyn Buck. 2 weeks after she's out, she's dead.
And how long do you plan to stay in Washington?
I will be in Washington until Lynn is free or dead, 9 to 5. I ask folks to come join me. If they can join me for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or a day, we are going to be there in the face of Mr. Obama.
Ralph Pointer, standing vigil for his wife, human rights lawyer Lynn Stewart. The actual state of civil liberties in America is more than ever in question after disclosures that the National Security Agency monitors the phone calls and internet activity of every American. We spoke with Dr. Johnny Williams, professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
This is a very troubling development, especially from the Obama administration. When Obama was first elected, one of the first things he said when it came to whether or not Vice President Cheney and President Bush should be prosecuted for violating the Geneva Convention and basically committing war crimes in Iraq was that he wanted to move on, and that's old news, that's in the past. But what he was doing was, as he has done throughout his career, was telegraphing us to say that he was going to continue to do what they were doing, so he didn't want to fear prosecution himself. And so now he's doing the same thing under the guise of the USA Patriot Act. And I think there's a particular section within the USA Patriot Act called Section 215, which allows for this data collection, a data mining, not only of telephone calls, but also of internet information, emails, browsing, and so forth, even video conferencing and calling via Skype and so forth. They were collecting information about that to see if people were terrorists and so forth. So basically, everything has fallen under the microscope of the National Security Agency to sift through its computers to basically follow everything that Americans are doing. And it's not just overseas. It's about just the average American telephone conversation, something that in the past you used to have a warrant to do, to wiretap. That's what they used to call it. Now they're doing it just verbatim without really any oversight from the Congress as well as from just the civilian courts. Now they have this secret court, the FSIA, which Obama first initially did not support it, but then eventually he did support it, that the telecommunication companies could not be sued for actually giving their records over to the government so they could spy on the American citizens. So it becomes very problematic. And it tells us that the people who are running the country and running the country at the behest of the very wealthy few of the corporations that they own are very scared of the fact that the average American citizen may themselves rise up and rebel against what is going on with them in terms of the redistribution of wealth from the average American to the top, and with this extreme economic inequality that is going on within the United States itself.
Yes, what kind of oversight is it when a senator or two and a congressman or two can be told about these kinds of practices but can't tell anybody else? It's like putting the information into a black hole.
Yeah, and that becomes problematic because basically they're not responsive to the people. Why do the people then give their rights to these representatives who are not really representing their interests? So it becomes a problem, like you say, a black hole. So what are they doing? Basically, it is what we call in the military CYA. You know, they're covering all their bottoms, and they're trying to make sure that they're not held legally culpable for something that has been recognized as legal by the USA Patriot Act, but which most people don't like. If the average American citizen knew exactly what the USA Patriot Act is doing when it comes to the erosion of civil rights and civil liberties, they would be up in arms. But most Americans are totally uninformed about that because we're preoccupied with consuming, even when we don't have money.
Yes, if the extent of the erosion of previously accepted civil rights is not known, then how do we know what other civil liberties that we think we still have been taken off of the books secretly?
So I think that's what the suit bought by Chris Hedges and Noam Chomsky and others are really about when it comes to the National Defense Authorization Act. It's really about trying to determine what that is. Even the Bradley Manning trial itself is really about trying to determine what has actually been eroded. But the government itself, under this cloak of secrecy, state secret, which is basically far beyond any of the administration, the Obama administration is cloaked in the secrecy beyond any other administration in history, is not willing to be honest with the American people and tell them their civil rights basically are non-existent to a great extent and that they could do anything. I mean, the first inkling of this erosion, this tremendous erosion, was when people took to the streets with the Occupy movement. And one would see the police doing heinous things, not only to the protesters, but to the journalists, arresting journalists for just filming them and so forth, which the court later overturned and said, hey, look, people can film you while you're engaging in the performance of your duties, and that's not illegal. But the fact is they are still harassing people along those lines. So the Occupy movement people are learning that you can't stand on a sidewalk. That's considered a lottery, so you have to constantly move. So it's really about a continual erosion of these things because the erosion is occurring because this wealth is being distributed to the top at these extreme kinds of rates, and the people at the top are concerned, and their representatives in the government as well as in the military are concerned that this kind of austerity, that it's just taking the money and giving it to the people who made bad choices at the top, bad decisions that have brought down the economy of the United States, and people on the bottom are not, they're not coming out of unemployment. So what's the alternative? Well, people are experiencing these things day to day in jobs that are not paying them well. They can't make a living. They're not making a living wage. They're making a minimum wage. And their response to this is to resist in some kind of way or to strike. Even collective bargaining is being held up as something that is not a right anymore, which started in Wisconsin, continued in Michigan, and now going all around the country with the Walmart strikes and so forth. So this destabilizing kind of operation that is going on among, say, just the average American is something that is feared by the people at the top. Therefore, we get this kind of creeping kind of surveillance state, which I don't think is creeping anymore. I actually think it's here. It is very, very strong.
It's now dawning on many Americans that the U.S. does not have a superior standard of living by many measurements in terms of economics and other quality of life issues. But the apologists always pointed to our vaunted civil liberties, and now we see we don't have those either.
First of all, I mean, the two are very much interrelated and connected in the sense that one can't have civil liberties unless one also has a decent standard of living. If you don't have a decent standard of living, why would you want to have civil liberties? You can't think about civil liberties. You're just trying to survive from day to day. So, no, our standard of living is atrocious. And it's all about me, 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 me. I mean, this individualistic kind of mentality that has been internalized in every American is that it's not about the group, what's best for the commons. It's only best for the individual. And so as a result, then, we got a standard of living where people are barely surviving. They're working two jobs, maybe even three jobs at minimum wage when they used to have a job, one job that paid well. But those jobs have been shipped overseas to lower paying labor, to China, to somewhere, say, South and Latin America, or to the Southern Hemisphere and so forth. Those jobs are gone. So what do Americans do? Well, one of the things in which Obama has come on board lately, when he said he was going to do it when he first got to office, but he didn't, was to say that they need to raise the minimum wage. And what he's raising it to is $9, which is really kind of atrocious, because even $9 minimum wage is still going to be below the poverty level when it gets to him. By 2015, when it's raised to $9, basically you're still going to be below poverty level. So what we need is something else. And one of the things that I've advocated in the past is a maximum wage and a minimum wage. Like, the maximum wage has to be tied to the minimum wage. And that is, if someone's going to want to make more money, the minimum wage has to rise with it. This has been proposed in the past. FDR proposed it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed it in this administration. And we had, at that time, every dollar a person earned, a rich person over, say, at that time, I think it was $250,000 in the 1940s, it was taxed at 94%. If you earned over $250,000, then $1 over that was taxed at 93 cents, and you got the rest. That money then can go back to help everybody else in society and so forth. It can alleviate this kind of tremendous economic disparity and inequality that we see in our society.
Professor Johnny Williams at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
The idea that the U.S. government is spying on virtually everybody comes as no shock to veterans of the struggle for social justice. Omali Yesha Taylor has been at odds with U.S. government policies for almost five decades. Yesha Taylor, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, thinks the NSA spying revelation may do real political damage to President Obama.
This issue of NSA spying may prove to be a real embarrassment for this president, and what I hope it will be is the straw that broke the camel's back, that people seemingly on both sides of the aisle and throughout the country from various political persuasions, many of them are extremely upset about this intervention, this NSA intervention, scooping up information, details from millions and millions of people from throughout the United States and the world. And I think that it is important that this has happened on Obama's watch, because It is one more thing that we can add to the list of offenses that Obama has committed against every assumption of democracy and democratic rights. And this is especially odious given the fact that African people in this country have been most responsible for leading the struggle for democracy, defining what democracy is and how it's going to look. And this guy, Obama, would be the one who would preside over this extraordinary Orwellian intervention in the lives and privacy of people throughout this country and around the world. So I just think that people find all kinds of ways to unite with imperialism, with capitalism, with terroristic intervention from the part of the capitalist state here. And Obama has given a lot of black people an opportunity to unite with imperialism, to unite with our own oppression.
You know, the broad outlines of this program have been generally known for years, and it was legislatively passed some years ago. But could it be that there's such consternation because finally broad masses of people realize that the government is not spying just upon, well, the folks they want spied upon, which includes large segments of their fellow Americans, but them?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, I think that's one of the real issues here. I mean, there's the Church Committee report in the 1970s. There was the COINTELPRO, the spying on all of us who were involved in the struggle for democracy and happiness inside this country. Initially, people would state that it wasn't really happening, that we were all paranoid with the assumption that the government was spying and intervening in people's lives and privacy. And then, like I said, there was the Church Committee report that laid it all out and that for a moment anyway seemed to have pushed them back. And now, and all of this was happening without any kind of real concern being expressed by ordinary people in this country, ordinary white people in this country. But now there was the assumption that you could spy on people who had been characterized as Islamic, which makes them suspects automatically. And now what is becoming clear is that there are no boundaries to this thing, that everybody is under the watch. And I think that is the basis for some people being concerned. I heard Snowden, the person who was the contract worker who dropped a dime on them, who put the word out, leaked this information, he's saying that he could have even have spied on the President of the United States. He's saying from the place he was located in this NSA structure that it was open to anybody was vulnerable. So I think this is one of the things that's caused some consternation, that indeed it is something that impacts on possibly on everybody in this country and most of the people in the world who have access to modern technology.
And this so-called mining of metadata, that is all the data that internet and phone connections can yield, creates patterns in which the spies that are, the powers that be who are spying, can make certain conclusions about not just who they're looking at, but who the people they're looking at may be connected to. It creates a kind of vast web of possible connections of subversion.
It does. And a problem is that we live at a time where I've heard it said, even the FBI agent, the Negro who was justifying, who put out the notice that they had upped the bounty on Asada Shakur's head to $2 million. I even heard him say that one of the charges that makes her dangerous is that she hates America. And I've heard more people say that that is evidence enough to say that somebody's terrorist or inclined to be a terrorist or extremely problematic to justify some kind of intervention through any means. So if hating America is a part of the criteria, I can see how moving through all of this stuff that they, all this information that they're collecting, they are likely, if there are a lot of sane people in the world, to pick on a lot of hatred for America. And that being the case, obviously it opens up a whole can of worms of possibilities of people who can be dealt with, because I don't think we're looking at something just simply for the purpose of collecting information, because it's something like stolen art you can look at in the privacy of your own home and enjoy it by yourself. I think this mining of data is for the purpose of doing something with it. of doing something, of acting out, of and I think that it means that everybody clearly who is involved in any kind of political action, especially progressive, put that in quotes, political action, especially actions that would challenge the status quo, is subject to special attention by the government and can be dealt with. This is an extremely serious and extremely important thing that we're looking at here.
You've just returned from extensive travel abroad. Folks abroad, many of them realize that the United States living standards have fallen, that U.S. quality of life is not as good as lots of other industrialized countries. But the United States always prided itself and said it was something special because of its vaunted liberties, its civil liberties. What does word of this NSA spying and all the rest do to that part of the American reputation?
Well, that's an interesting point because it depends on who we were talking to. If we were reading, for example, British newspapers while we were there, and we were seeing editorial expressions of disappointment and also suspicions about the relationship that the British has with this entire process, because England, it's illegal in England to do what the U.S. has been doing here, but England has been in on it. Therefore, they share the information with England so England could have it without having, formally having broken the law. So there's, in British newspapers, there are a lot of concerns precisely because the U.S. has put forth itself as this democratic beacon. And then much of the work that I was doing on the ground was in the African communities. We were in England, Paris, France. We were in Cologne and Berlin, Germany. And also we were in Stockholm, Sweden. And the discussion in these areas were different because here people were talking about an ongoing kind of oppression of black people in all these places and the kinds of things that we've had to endure. So in many ways, that's sort of, I don't know if we would characterize it as a subtext, but it's certainly, you know, the thing that we've always had to live with. Even the beginning of this discussion makes the assumption that, I think correctly so, that people can now be upset about being spied on after we've seen disaster rained down against our community as a consequence of this spying. And this is just people who were trying to win our freedom. How long was Martin Luther King spied on? How long was Malcolm X and Huey Newton and all of us who were involved in the struggle at that moment until they militarily broke us back using this kind of bugging and this kind of intervention into all the privacy that was there? And then I'm looking at somebody like the impact of this kind of security state where anything that one does is up for criminalization. The Lynn Stewart, who's for all practical purposes serving a death sentence for simply getting in touch with the media. Asada Shakur, who I stated clearly, this FBI guy says that she is this arch number one terrorist because even 40 years later, she hates America. She's doing these things someplace, these subversive things that's going around hating America. So, I mean, I think that we've seen a real criminalization, a process of criminalizing political action, and then we've got this massive intervention into privacy, looking at or having access to emails and phones and every other means by which people are trying to communicate and talk to each other. So it's insidious. And people in Europe, even sectors of the ruling class, through their media, were expressing some alarm at what they were seeing through this. And some were challenging the likelihood that the British government itself is culpable, and therefore there should be questions raised on that front as well. So I think it's a discussion that's happening in all of these places, and I think that the people are expressing some kind of concern. Of course, there's a lot of hypocrisy there, as you know, because much of Europe has been in bed with the United States in a very serious way with the renditions and everything else that they've all united to do to keep people from winning their freedom.
But, of course, we should expect a diminution of civil liberties here at home when the United States routinely violates the national sovereignty of nations abroad.
I think that's true, but I think one of the things that's spectacular here, and like you said, this is stuff that's been going on for ages, but it seems to me that there is a serious escalation and clamping down under this regime. under the Obama regime. I don't know if this kind of information could have come out under Bush or even under Clinton, and there'd not be much more furor about it, even from some of the people who, like the Negro politician that you mentioned when we first opened up this discussion. I don't think those people would be there. I think that Obama's been quite successful in maintaining relatively good poll numbers, even as the Congress and even as his policies have shown people have had a lot of disagreement with those, primarily because of the strong base that he has in the African community. The community for whom he has done nothing continues up to now anyway to offer enough support for him to keep his poll numbers relatively good. But if I'm looking at social media, what I'm seeing, and of course this is simply anecdotal, but I'm looking at social media and I'm seeing a lot of distaste for this guy, a lot more. We didn't see this stuff, you know, a couple of years ago, how just on Facebook and various other social media entities that people are condemning in very strong terms Barack Hussein Obama.
So he may have lost his Teflon as well as his rock-solid black support.
I think that definitely that there is a chink in his armor, and I think that we really need to dig in on this thing because Obama, what he has been a very insidious force here. I mean, the thing, for example, with Assata Shakur, and I don't intend to wander off the subject, but the thing with Assata Shakur, which I don't think a white president could have got away with doing as easily, because what he has done with this is to attempt to delegitimize the whole struggle for black people going back forever with this characterization of Assata Shakur being a terrorist. And that means that anybody who supports Assata Shakur, who welcomes Assata Shakur, can therefore be charged with supporting terrorism. And I don't think anybody could have got away with an attack on the whole black liberation movement. Even if they wanted to say something bad about Assata Shakur, I don't think a white president could have got away with it any more than a white president could have got away with denunciation of reparations as a viable demand by the African community without this guy having first done it. And I think that Obama may have opened the door. His intention is to have opened the door with the attack on Assata Shakur. And if you attack, if you can delegitimize the black movement in this country, which is the fundamental force that has pushed for democracy and rights in this country, if you can delegitimize that, then you've delegitimized the whole struggle for progress and social transformation. And Obama has carried the water for that, and it makes it easy to do the kind of thing that he's trying to do right now. I do believe, however, and I'm not talking about Africans so much at the moment as I am about the general white population and others who may find this latest thing with the NSA, the revelations, so to speak, disturbing enough to offer a problem for this administration, that even the thing about the guns in Mexico and the Obamacare and all these other things seem not to have succeeded in doing up to now. I think that one of the things that I find disturbing is that even as we talk about NSA, it may be relatively problematic because we're at a time, place where the whole country has opened up itself for its personal business to be, you know, everywhere. I mean, people put everything on Facebook, all of their business, all of their affairs. They tweet everything they're doing, from eating breakfast to using the toilet. They got these reality shows where that invites people into their homes. So the whole question of privacy, it may be taking a pretty serious lick right now at this time where this issue of the NSA spying is before us as well. I don't know.
That was Somali Yeshin Taylor of the Blackest Back Coalition speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
The U.S. government justifies its massive spying against Americans as necessary to detect attackers from groups like Al-Qaeda. However, the United States is now openly arming Al-Qaeda-affiliated fighters attempting to bring down the government in Syria. Washington tries to justify its actions based on the highly questionable doctrine of humanitarian military intervention. Hajamu Baraka is a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. He recently appeared on the radio program Moving the Center at the Pacifica-affiliated station WRFG in Atlanta, Georgia. Host Kali Aset Amen asked Baraka, why are the U.S. and its allies attempting to overthrow Syria's government?
The U.S. strategic objectives in the so-called Middle East is to prevent any effective opposition to its interests in that region. That was one reason why they moved on Iraq. But as a consequence of that miscalculation, they in fact enhanced the power of Iran. So now the main objective now is to isolate politically and militarily the Iranian regime. So the Syrian government was key in that strategic objective.
And they couldn't achieve that through the kinds of backroom dealings that we come to expect. Rather, they decided to support a more brazen kind of effort that would ultimately topple the government. They were out of options diplomatically, in other words.
They didn't exercise those options because the option of peaceful democratic reform was on the table. But they opted for a military direction because for them it was a win-win. Either they would effect regime change, or they would create a situation where you have chaos and the possible dismemberment of the Syrian state. So either way, they were going to win.
And this is a theme we see over and over again. But most recently, there was a similar strategy and rhetoric involved in justifying the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And so with respect to Syria, is there to some degree just a rerun of Libya?
Well, Libya became the playbook, and Libya and even to a certain extent Iraq. But that was part of the effort to shift the balance of forces more strongly in favor of the U.S. and its Western allies. So using the script of Libya and the symbolism of Tunisia and Egypt, they moved to try to effect regime change in Syria.
You talk about symbolism, that is absolutely key, because what is at issue is the way in which these conflicts are framed to achieve buy-in, to use these framing tactics for propagandistic purposes. And your article, Syria and the Sham of Humanitarian Intervention, needles in on just that, the ways in which rhetoric are used to justify particular kinds of political and military actions. Explain your argument there.
Basically, this humanitarian intervention is a concept that was created in the West that the central element of it is that when there are regimes, governments that are not respecting the fundamental rights, human rights of its citizens, then there is a right and indeed a responsibility to intervene, to come in to protect the right to protect that civilian population. It means that these governments have, in effect, given up their right to sovereignty and that the international community has a responsibility to, in fact, intervene. Now, on one level, one can make a plausible argument that there is a moral basis for that. But when you look at how this concept has played out in terms of policy, you see it as not having the kind of moral consistency one would assume. In fact, the way it's played out is that it has become now a convenient instrument on the part of the more powerful states, the U.S. and its Western allies, to selectively intervene to so-called protect civilian populations when it's been in their geopolitical interest to do so.
So give us some other examples of that, because this is a systematic practice, as you point toward.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they go back and they talk about the intervention by the West in places like Bosnia. They go back and suggest that if they had a more coherent policy of intervention, that they would have been able to save the lives that were lost in Rwanda. They justify humanitarian intervention into Libya to protect the people of Benghazi. They suggest that they needed to be able to base their forces in Africa, using the example of the large resistance army in Uganda as an example of where it would be morally beneficial and supportive to go into a country to rid them of a tyrant like that organization. So it's been used politically and ideologically to sort of prop up this notion of not just humanitarian intervention, but humanitarian intervention on the part of European governments who have historically abrogated to themselves the right to determine what states, what governments have sovereignty, where people and when people are able to engage in self-determination. It is an extension of sort of a colonial mentality that's been accepted by the populations of these governments, so that when the U.S. talked about the need to intervene into Syria, it resonates with people in the U.S. When they talk about the need to go in and overthrow Gaddafi, it resonates because it is the benevolence of the West to go in and to rid these regimes of these savage governments, to save these people in those countries who really just want to be like the people in the West. So it's been used ideologically to show up support for basically what I argue is imperialist intervention.
I want to ask you about the recent appointment of Susan Rice as National Security Advisor. What's Susan Rice's stance on Syria? Has she made that public? Will she be influential, perhaps in a positive or progressive direction, in shaping U.S. policy on humanitarian issues in Syria?
No. And when we look at the appointment of Susan Rice, we need to bring in also the individual who is going to be taking her place at the UN, Samantha Powers. Both of these individuals are what we call liberal interventionists. They are at the center of this notion of the responsibility and the right of the West in particular to intervene to save populations. Now, Susan Rice has a very aggressive position on Syria. While she was involved in a decision that was made by the U.S. government not to openly arm the resistance, even though they were doing that through their surrogates in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, she has made her position very clear that she sees the Assad regime as illegitimate and that it must go. So we don't expect anything progressive to come out of U.S. policy as a consequence of her being appointed as National Security Advisor. In fact, we see more of the same, if not a pickup in the aggressiveness from the U.S. and from the West.
And then what? You know, we've got the fall of regime after regime in the Middle East. The U.S. is everywhere complicit in this domino effect. Ordinary people around the world are generally worse off or doing just as badly as before. I mean, what cause does anyone have to say that any of these interventions were worth it?
Well, they're not worth it. I mean, but what we are seeing, what we're witnessing, is a desperate attempt on the part of the U.S. and the West to maintain their global hegemony. And they have opted for a strategy that suggests that they're willing to shoot their way into continued hegemony. So their objective in the Middle East, their objective in the Pacific realm, basically is to use their overwhelming military power to try to maintain their economic dominance in a world in which they are slipping economically. So it really is important for people in the U.S. to understand what is going on and to understand where their objective interests lie. Do they continue to support the 1%? In these military adventures around the world that is draining the U.S. economy, draining the U.S. budget of needed resources that could be invested socially within the U.S.? Or do they attempt to begin to put some real constraints on their governments to begin to look internally at their own issues, their own contradictions, and use those resources to address those issues? Are they going to stand in solidarity with the people around the world who are attempting to exercise their right to self-determination, their right to a national development, free of the control and the dominance of these Western colonial powers?
Ajamu Baraka on radio station WRFG in Atlanta with host Kali Aset Amen.
Anna Edwards is a radio talk show host in Richmond, Virginia, and an editor of the local newspaper, Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. Edwards and other activists have fought to preserve the historical site called Shaco Bottom in the oldest section of Richmond. Developers attempted to turn the site into a baseball stadium. Now the city is entertaining plans for a shopping mall. We ask Edwards, why is the battle for Shaco Bottom so important?
Shaco Bottom is the birthplace of the city of Richmond. And since the city of Richmond, like so many cities in the United States, were born out of a slave society, without them, these places would not have been built, and they certainly would not have thrived and made the money for the United States that it did. And for the city of Richmond, which is also the capital of the state of Virginia, and Virginia was the first colony, it has some particular significance. Shaco Bottom is intriguing because it is a place where some of the buildings, some of the pavement, and some of the sites from those earliest years of Richmond's history still exist. You can walk the streets where our ancestors walked. Our struggle to reclaim Richmond's African burial ground was in Shaco Bottom. The historic district that includes the trail of enslaved Africans, the walk that those people took when they were brought to Richmond from boats on the dock, the Manchester docks on the south side of the river, and then walked across the river in the dead of night and placed into jails and holding pens and moved to auction houses. Those pathways are still here and some of the buildings are still here. In the last few years, some of those other sites that have been more invisible have been brought to visibility. One of those sites is the Lumpkins Jail slave trading complex that was owned by Robert Lumpkins. And Robert Lumpkins' widow was Mary Lumpkins, who was, in fact, a mulatto woman that he had bought and then later married and had children with. And when he died after the Civil War, she's the person who leased some of those buildings to the educator who later the site became the origins of Virginia Union University, which is one of our historically black colleges here in Richmond and in Virginia. So this place is loaded with all that walkable, touchable history, such that it lends itself to, rather than being eradicated once again, to the kind of development that would allow a cultural and historical exploration of this place, which all economists that we have been able to track down, and not just us, other people who actually don't even care about the black history of this site, but care about the economics of development, will say that there is much greater potential for economic development in historic and cultural sites like this than in a baseball or sports stadium complex as an economic driver. So we have sort of several reasons for why this is a bad idea, but the most important to us is the fact that this is a site which its entire uniqueness and its entire ability to convey what the story, the real story of the United States and its development is, would be completely eradicated if they went ahead with this project.
Richmond is majority black. Its mayor is black. Why are you having these difficulties in preserving such an important black historical location?
Well, some people would say it's because those people who are interested in the economic development of this city are not at all interested in having it be based on its black history. The fact that we have a black mayor is, in some regards, no more impactful than to preserving and protecting black history than us having a black president. You know, there will be challenges to that, but the truth is that they stepped into a role that means they are participatory in the electoral politics, and the electoral politics are subject to corporate politics. And the corporate politics are not necessarily those that are going to support the right path, but the profitable path. And the profit that we're talking about is short term. We're talking about profit that is going to go to the developers and to the landowners, not to the community in the long run.
Shaco Bottom, we see from your literature, it was the second largest market for enslaved Africans in the entire North American continent. And I'm told that you yourself are descended from some of the people that were sold out of that slave market.
That is true. This market, once the transatlantic slave trade was abolished in 1808, it was the internal trade in enslaved Africans that dramatically increased and dramatically increased in profitability. And Virginia is one of those states that became kind of, some people have called it the Ellis Island of the internal slave trade, meaning that people passed through Virginia and were sold into the Deep South and into the Louisiana Purchase Territory. Because after 1804, when France sold those territories to the United States, it suddenly doubled the land mass and the capacity for agricultural economy development. So there was a great need for more enslaved labor. And so Virginia became one of those places. And it is true, as far as we know in my story, the anecdotes come down that we have at least one, but probably two of my great-great-grandmother ancestors were sold out of Richmond to two different families who ultimately migrated both to Louisiana and to Texas.
Now, Shaco Bottom is actually centrally located in Richmond. It's the site not just of the history of those who are descended from the slaves, but the history of Richmond itself. One would think that lots of white folks would want to preserve it as well.
Well, and in fact, they do. What we have found in this particular struggle, because we faced this particular battle of this baseball stadium proposal at least three times before, but each time it's happened, it's failed because of the fact that they couldn't get their financing plotting together. This time, they seem possibly to have it more together, but at the same time, more and more people have learned about the history of Shaco Bottom, in part due to our efforts with the newspaper and the radio program and our ongoing events, but also through their own effort and certainly homeowners in that area and the cultural institutions, I should say, especially those that have more recently been involved in the Future of Richmond's Past, which is a body that has looked at how to coordinate its programming regarding the 150-year anniversary of the Civil War and emancipation. There's a lot more focus on the history of Richmond specifically from the time period of the height of the slave trade. And so people really are starting to pay attention to the fact that there's a tremendous Jewish history down there. There is a tremendous immigrant history in terms of workers. This was a highly industrialized city very, very early on, and certainly after the Civil War. So yeah, a lot of people are starting to figure out that their roots are in this place too, and that we're going to trade it in for a shopping mall. So I think we've got people who are participating with that perspective. We have people who are supporting now from the environmental perspective, because this development follows Shaco Creek, which is the lowest point in the city. It is a floodplain and requires tremendous expense just to deal with that. And it's also the center of the, if you look at just the history of trade and transportation, that is all here. Boat transportation from the earliest years, train transportation for the decades that it was dominant. Then you have the roads, and in fact, we're in the path of the airlines, if you want to look at air travel as far as freight moving through the city. So Shaco Bottom really is the epicenter of Richmond's history for all its people. And we just have an opportunity to capitalize on the fact that people are concerned about the fact that they have marginalized Black history, and it does have some weight. The fact that our leaders find that they need to pay more attention to corporate sponsors and some of the old money or interests of Virginia is just sort of a continuation of a sad chapter in this place's history.
And how can those of us who are not in Richmond help out?
Well, you can be of tremendous help, because we, in a way, have our local bases very well covered. We've got a petition. We have, as I've described, more support than we've had in the past locally for this, and they are contributing to the kind of arguments that we were able to present, including the way that the finances are also being addressed. But outside of Richmond, the more voices that we have that are saying, but this is also our history. If it's Richmond's and Virginia's history, it's U.S. history, it's also our history, and for you to eradicate it in this way is shameful. And the opportunities for doing something much better are certainly there, and why can't you put your efforts into that? I think the voices that we have from outside of Virginia that come from, again, all these same kinds of spectrums can be very, very helpful to help Richmonders understand how they are seen in relation to the rest of the country. You know, Richmond matters the same way I would think, you know, New York matters. The New York African Burial Ground is terribly important. It was declared by Smithsonian Institution to be one of the most important discoveries for archaeology and anthropology in the United States when it came about. It said the same thing about the Lumpkins Jail site here in Richmond when that was excavated in 2008. So we know the value.
That was Anna Edwards of the newspaper Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. Dr. Gerald Horn is a fountain of knowledge on the subject of Black history. Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and a prolific author. He is also a regular guest on the Saturday morning show on Regent Radio in Toronto, Canada, hosted by Norman Richmond. Richmond asked Dr. Horn, how would he respond to Black Americans who might ask, why should we support the Palestinians? What have they done for us? Dr. Horn said, the question itself is uninformed.
It's well known that they have very close relations historically with the Southern Africans. Their ambassador in Zimbabwe, when I was living there, was one of the most fervent supporters of the liberation movements in the region. I should say that what the Palestinians were able to do, even though they didn't have sovereignty, was that they did a much better job than I would say many of these Africans in North America in terms of lobbying on behalf of African liberation. I mean, these Africans in North America really should have a bit more humility, it seems to me. I mean, you know, I'm doing this book on Haiti now. And so, you know, the Haitians in the 19th century, they campaigned vigorously on behalf of enslaved Africans in the United States and in Canada. That's why so many Africans from Canada and the United States wound up moving to Haiti. But then, after slavery was abolished in the United States, you had people like Frederick Douglass, bless his soul. I have no bone to pick with Frederick Douglass, but he became an emissary on behalf of the United States when the United States was basically trying to take over the entire island of Hispaniola and nix both Dominican Republic and Haiti. And Frederick Douglass was down with that. And so was John Langston, the ancestor of Langston Hughes, for example, who was also a U.S. emissary in Haiti. You know, I'm reading this case now of this slave trader, French slave trader, Pelletier, who during the U.S. Civil War was trying to seize Haitians and then sell them to slavery in Dixie, which of course, you know, that was not unknown at that time. But then he brought this lawsuit against the Haitians, saying that they put him in jail and they harassed him after he was caught trying to capture their citizens and take them to Dixie. And, of course, Frederick Douglass and John Langston, they supported the United States position, which was to crack down on the Haitians. So anyway, you know, before these people start asking those sorts of questions, I think they need a briefing on basic historical facts.
What has the Black American political class been doing while Barack Obama presided over Black economic decline and increasing assaults on civil liberties? Mostly, they've been circling the wagon around the first Black president. However, even some of Obama's Black supporters have run out of patience. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
It's taken 4 years and 5 months, but only this week did we witness the first White House demonstration by activists from the more traditional sector of Black politics. That is, those who have stood by Obama from the moment his candidacy was deemed viable, but are now, well, somewhat upset. Led by Dr. Ron Daniels and his Institute of the Black World, and joined by Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., several hundred African Americans gathered in Lafayette Park in front of the Executive Mansion. In Dr. Daniels' words, the demonstrators were frustrated and angry at the president's reluctance to openly address what can only be considered a moral and political crisis in terms of depression levels of joblessness, horrific gun violence, fratricide, and mass incarceration in urban inner-city Black communities. In a commentary shortly before the event, Dr. Daniels wrote that, for some, Obama is like a Black Nero fiddling while Black communities are imploding. I checked with journalists and activists in Washington to confirm that this was the first White House demonstration of Obama's presidency by Blacks who had previously supported him. However, other Blacks have marched to the White House to protest and denounce the first Black president's domestic and foreign policies. That distinction goes to the Black Is Back Coalition, which marched on the White House twice, the first time in November of 2009, and then again the next year. The Black Is Back Coalition predicted early on that Obama would be a servant of the rich and the Pentagon, and they were right. Black Is Back also said that knee-jerk, reflexive Black support for Obama would only encourage and legitimize his inherently anti-Black policies. Monday's demonstration comes 2 election seasons late, although late is better than never. The demonstration was also mislabeled as a day of direct action. Dr. Daniels and Reverend Jackson know full well that direct action has historically consisted of tactics of resistance such as sit-ins, strikes, blockades of traffic, property takeovers, and filling up jails. In Dr. Martin Luther King's words, and we quote him here, "Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks to so dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored." Dr. Daniels and Reverend Jackson don't even pretend that they're attempting to create a crisis that the Obama administration must confront. Daniels himself says the demonstration was intended as a wake-up call for Obama, which is something quite different than a crisis purposely brought about by direct action. Plus, direct action is always accompanied by demands, not requests and suggestions, but demands, with the clear understanding that rejection of those demands will bring consequences that will heighten the state of crisis. None of that occurred on Monday. With Obama now a lame duck, many in the black political class will seek to rewrite the histories of their own behavior during this shameful period when black folks rolled over en masse for a corporate shill with a brown face. There will be lots of play-acting and revisionism, along with hopefully some actual resistance. Let's be clear about the difference between direct action and political theater.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.